Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Jeff Gibbs. He's the director, writer, and producer of Planet of the Humans and was co-producer of Bowling for Columbine and Fahrenheit 9/11. He was born in Flint, Michigan. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Oh, thanks, Derek. It's an honor to be here and a joy to commiserate with you about the state of things.
Yeah. So tell us about Planet of the Humans. What is it? What's the point of it? And then if you want, how did it come to be?
Let me start with the last one first and see where we get. Because I was thinking earlier, you know, Flint, Michigan. Where did this start? I was a kid who grew up in the rough side of Flint that you see in Bowling for Columbine, you know, where the little girl was killed.
Yeah.
And because I knew Michael later from high school, I said, you know, let me get, you know, do you mind if I help out? And I wound up quitting my job and joining them for Bowling for Columbine. But the journey really began. My mom was a single parent and we lived on a dirt street. Sometimes we didn't know what we were going to have to eat. You know, I thought that canned tomatoes were just my mom's favorite food instead of that's what we had in the house, you know, tonight. Didn't see my dad for, you know, decades. And, it was one of these, it was the wealthiest industrial place on the planet, it was said. You know, the workers could afford all the goodies of boats and snowmobiles and a cabin, but it was extremely rough. You know, there was 5 miles of factory outside my back door. An oil tank once blew up. I was kind of a kid who just was different from the very beginning. But in that environment where I didn't have a dad and my mom was gone working all the time and it was a rough industrial area and I was always reading books. That was the one thing that really saved me, is just the ability to read and to escape that way. But the other thing was, from the very time I was able to climb a tree, climbing a tree and being able to sit in the branches of an apple tree, or sit in the branches of a what are they called, the Dutch elm? Not the Dutch elm, but the I forget what the type it is. It's related to a maple. And then there were, even on this edge of Flint, there were fields that had been overgrown and weren't mowed very much. So there was a lot of insects, dandelions, wild chicory, Queen Anne's lace, and butterflies. And I think those two things really saved me. And in fact, around the time I started working on Bowling for Columbine, I also wanted to become a solo piano. I was doing a solo piano thing and had a CD in release. So I titled all the songs on my CD, you know, like, the willow tree, because we had a big willow tree in our backyard. We didn't have any air conditioning, and that's where you were all summer. So I guess this movie goes way back to me really being saved by science fiction and the ability to dream and to think, and the natural world around me, because that's, you know, about all I had in terms of sustaining me. You know, very rarely commiserated with adults in a way that felt personal or intellectual or anything else. So, and then as you see in the movie, you see my background where a little bit. Where I know it's not probably a little bit unbelievable, but, you know, when I was 9 years old, we had moved and we were near this amazing woods with really tall trees and elderberries and little trails through there, and kind of a nice northern hardwood forest that hadn't been cut yet. Except, of course, then a bulldozer showed up and started knocking the trees down. So I had a cousin that lived in the country, and we had learned to be a little bit of wild kids out in the woods there. So I just thought, I got this idea, I should try and figure out how to stop the bulldozer. So I really did. I tried to bend over trees and saplings and put some stones and sticks on there. I tried to dig holes in the trail. And then finally, I parked the bulldozer near our apartment building. I really did walk over to it one Sunday morning and unscrew the gas cap and put in a handful of sand. Walked away and never went back to the woods because they were pretty soon gone. So that's my foundation. And I think as I got older, I just realized all the things I had feared when I was younger were coming true. And I told myself probably 20 years ago, if I'm a good person on this planet and if I'm to do my part, you know, and you realize everything around us is dying, what are we required to do? So that was really the beginning of the exploration that led me to making this film.
A couple of things. One of them is when I watched your film with my friend, and when the scene came up where you talked about putting the sand in the bulldozer gas tank, my friend turned to me and said, "He's our people."
The way I take that is, I'm not sure that I want to try and pull this down. I think if it comes all tumbling down, what my biggest worry is that it'll just, you know, it could be, you know, it's unpredictable. I'm a nonviolent person, let me put it that way. But I've always wondered why more people didn't have the urge to just go, oh my God, this is how can we be knocking the tops off mountains for coal? And little did I know, someday I would be filming the scene where we're knocking the tops off mountains, you know, for wind. And it was during this exploration of what's going wrong, and I really did make several trips to West Virginia. My grandmother's from Boone, grew up within sight of Grandfather Mountain. I don't know if you're familiar with the Appalachians.
Not really.
Down there, but it's a beautiful area, and not far from West Virginia. In fact, family members in those days would go back and forth and work in the coal mines and that sort of thing.
North Carolina?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I know where that is. Yeah, I'm familiar with that.
Yeah, Blue Ridge Parkway. So I went down there a few times just to learn about air pollution. You know, it's always been bad down there. And, to really just get a sense of mountaintop removal and why it was going on. I really did start out not completely traditional, but asking similar questions to other people. You know, why are we addicted to oil? Why are we, you know, how can we knock the tops off mountains? And then you realize there's not really a sustainable way to do this civilization. And I think you're one of the first people that kind of ever read or heard of that was asking some of those questions a long time ago. The questions you're not permitted to ask.
There's a couple of things I want to say. One of them is that one of the things that I desperately loved about the film is that there's a line in Naomi Klein's film where she says basically that I wish the polar bears well, but after all of these climate change marches and everything, the polar bears don't do it for her. And it's all about us. And I'm going to go a different direction too. And so many indigenous people have said to me that the first and most important thing that we have to do is to decolonize, they say, our hearts and minds. And one of the things that means is to switch our loyalty away from the system and to the living planet that's the source of all life. And one of the things that I adore about your film is that it's very clear from the first moment to the end that your loyalty is with the living planet. And then I want to say one more thing about that, which is my dear environmentalist friend John Osborne, who was really my environmental mentor, he has said so many times, a lot of environmentalists begin by wanting to protect a specific piece of ground, and they end up questioning the foundations of civilization. And I feel like with those questions, I wanted to say those things, but I feel like I'm getting a little bit off track. And can we back up a little bit? And for those who have not yet seen the film, can we give like a little summary? I feel like people could be listening and going, wow, this is a really interesting conversation, but what are they talking about?
Yeah, Planet of the Humans. It's an hour and 40-minute documentary, and it's where I ask questions about really how we got off track into this green energy fantasy that the only story we're in is climate change. That's the underlying problem, and that the solution somehow is technology, that technology is going to save us. And we follow my journey of discovery where I realized these things that I had wanted on my roof, weren't what they seemed. And but I think the larger picture is that this is kind of it's a stand-in. You know, I just wanted to make a movie about what's happening in the world, how we're depleting resources, how we're, you know, attacking every ecosystem, how we're prioritizing ourselves and our well-being over the well-being of everything else on the planet. And so you kind of get that story through the story of the environmental movement, oddly enough, and how the environmental movement getting into bed with capitalism and the profit motive and the story of infinite growth, just the green version of it, how that's the same story of destruction that we've been fed through fossil fuels and through the traditional things that we're opposing as environmentalists. So, and in another way, we're getting the story of what's going on with the planet at the same time. Everybody told me when I was making the movie that was just nature focused, that nobody wanted to see that film. And I don't know what you make of that, but I tend to think that that might be true, that, I don't think there's been the definitive film made on how the what's really going on the planet. Just the first few pages I read of your book, nobody's made that film, right? I don't think they've made it. Quine Scotzi,
but that's a long time ago.
Long time ago, and that's still sort of nonspecific. But the story you're telling is the one I wanted to tell. But it began to feel like a wall was already up because, I've already seen that movie. I've already seen about the downfall of nature. I'm like, well, what did you see exactly? An Inconvenient Truth that just covers climate? So it's an interesting thought that people feel like they've seen this story and don't want to see it. Even though I don't think it's been told, at least not in a way that's gotten out, to the world. And into the common discourse.
Given that we're talking about life on the only planet in the universe that we know of that has life, I don't think that that's a story that can be told enough times. Even if it had been told, it needs to be told again and again until we get it enough that we act to stop the destruction. But before that can happen, I think we need to switch our loyalty away from the system and to the planet, which again is something for which I will be eternally grateful for you in this film for doing. And do you have – go ahead, please.
How could we ever get that mixed up? You know, one of the things more recently as we were finishing the film, it dawned on me is that unfortunately – nature dies first and then the humans. I mean, a lot of humans are suffering and having a really rough time, but generally speaking, that's the order. And so if we died first and then nature, I think we'd worry a lot more. But because we're able to use these mountains and oceans of fossil fuels to fight off the ill effects of the declining and dying planet, it creates this illusion that everything's going to be okay. Because it's okay for us. And there's even a movement in the about 8 or 9, 10 years ago called LOHAS. I don't know if you heard of that. It was out in California. Lifestyles of Health and Sustainability. And, at first it sounded good. Just like, yes, you can have an organic hemp handbag and you can we're going to have organic, eco fashion models. And we're going to have it didn't take me long to realize, oh my God, here's what they're trying to do. They're trying to conflate what's good for us in this consumptive culture with what's good for the planet. And the planet doesn't want us to buy a billion electric cars or a billion hemp handbags any more than it does a billion plastic handbags. I mean, it's still a billion. It's still an unsustainable level of consumption. So I'm a bit of a curmudgeon in that way. Like, you know, at this level of consumption and population, we're going to switch to hemp, really? How many millions and hundreds of millions of acres do we have to plow up to grow the hemp? And then there's this fantasy, oh, hemp doesn't use resources. Well, you know, every plant that grows, that you just grow and grow, needs fertilizer. It needs, you know, in the traditional agricultural system. Now, if hemp was growing wild and there was some sustainable culture that was, you know, in relationship with the hemp, that's different. But the idea that somehow, you know, that there's any way that we can switch ourselves over to some different system and just keep running it on, you know, just keep the lifestyle going. It's just, you know, dawned on me that it's insanity, really. And so, you know, I'm probably pretty dark in terms of how far gone we are. I don't know if you know, you know, if anybody else is this dark, but when I put that chart in the movie, and it's just easily verified data, you know, I was just looking up a couple things just for background for the movie to put out there for people, but it's easily verifiable that our energy use has increased by thousands of times over the last few thousand years, thousands of times. It's easily verifiable that our economic footprint on this planet is 10 times higher than it was not that long ago. And population times per person consumption since we got onto fossil fuels is literally 100 times higher presence. And I keep thinking, wow, the last time most of humanity, all of humanity, just lived on the balance of the planet, the biosphere, and we weren't even sustainable then, and now we're 100 times higher than that. So that's really, if you want to get down to the core motivation for making this, that precipice we're on and how, what it would mean to just, for that to just crash, what it would mean for all the humans, and in some ways, just as importantly or more importantly, all the non-human species that don't deserve to die and be snowed under in this collapse. So that's what scared the hell out of me.
One of the things that I find really offensive is that I have been accused for many years of hating humans, and you're getting accused of that now. And the truth is that I think that the humans who come after us are going to wonder what was wrong with us that we didn't, that the humans who come after are not going to applaud the people who are living currently for cutting down forests to put in wind energy harvesting facilities. They, insofar as anybody is alive in 100 years, they're going, if they're going to applaud any of us, it's going to be the people who protected wild nature. Because the people who come after are primarily going to care about whether they can drink the water and breathe the air and whether the planet will support them. They're not going to care about whether we had really groovy technology that made this current system, omnicidal system, last another 10 years. And again, am I misreading your film? I mean, these are my thoughts, but it's also, I saw them reflected in your film. Am I reading you correctly?
Yeah, it's exactly that. I think I put it slightly different as, you know, we think of putting up a wind turbine or driving an electric car or putting up solar panels as something good for nature. What species exactly wants us to install 100,000 square miles of solar panels? I don't know what species that is. You know,
Homo colossus.
Say that again?
Homo colossus.
Yeah, Homo colossus. Yeah, and so one of the things I wanted to try and do in the film, and I hope it came across, was I was inspired by Ishmael, Daniel Quinn's book, and, you know, 2001, I'm a science fiction, you know, oddly enough, I think science fiction offers often a perspective on the human species that you don't get, and that's what I liked about 2001, whatever else anybody might say about it, but this perspective where we look at ourselves as a single species. We look at ourselves as other species might see us. We look at ourselves as if we were a visiting being from another planet, or a god of some kind, or mythical. You know, that's something I wanted to have sort of be in the movie, and you know, underscore this journey. So we don't. One of the things I've realized making the film, that we don't even have a language, a good language. The Anthropocene is like, what does that mean? It doesn't even have face validity for people. So what is the word for our total human presence? What is the word for a single species overrunning a finite planet? You can just say climate, and everybody spools out in their brain all the things to do with climate change, warming, CO2. But what is the word that encapsulates us? What's the word that encapsulates just the collective damage that we're doing? Biodiversity, I mean, it's more than that. That leaves out the mining, you know, the agriculture. I mean, it's all connected. So, I mean, tell me if I'm missing something, but it seems like this is such a blind spot. We don't have a language for it. And when you try and use language, people pick out a word, you know, and pick on that, or, oh, you hate humans. You know, it's just, that's just nuts. And it's, if it wasn't so silly, you know, my first, career was as a social worker. And I decided that I had a responsibility, because of my rough upbringing, you know, and it's probably a way of healing myself, you know, full disclosure, but I decided to help, you know, start social service programs. Michael and I actually started a crisis hotline the year after we were in high school, and did that for a couple of years. I was a therapist and ran a treatment center for the worst kids in our state that had been through families with drug addiction and been on the streets themselves, and you know, were either going to wind up in prison or in a mental institution. I did some of the first therapy groups for people that have been victims of abuse, men and women in our community. So before I made the switch, I was completely dedicated to the idea of love and care for our fellow humans. And, you know, what are ways to create community and to that using that word, as long as you're letting me ramble, that's one of the where I was coming to as a therapist was that with all the therapy in the world, with all the yoga in the world, with all the, you know, acupuncture, whatever we want to do to take care of ourselves in the world, that the fundamental thing that was missing was a sense of community, and not the sense of community where you've got a social worker and a counselor, you know, and a teacher, and a probation officer, but a sense of community because you know your neighbors, and your neighbors and you both know where you get the food from, and you know the people where you get your food from. And you go to the same school that your parents went to, and you know some of the same teachers are still there. And your spirituality comes not from someplace else in the world, but from where you live. And I realized that this disconnect with all these different things that humans were meant to live in, you know, for thousands of years, when I believe, tell me if this is wrong, but in most cultures, the grandparents and extended family lived in the home. And that was true up until, I think, the earliest 20th century. And then by the end of the 20th century, something like 95%, 97% of grandparents didn't live in the home. So we've been disconnecting ourselves, not only from nature, but from each other. And so many of the ills that we experience emotionally and psychologically come from that. And so we're trying to make up for this with goodies and stuff and therapy, you know, and it's, I don't think it's been very effective. So it's the same thing to understand we're part of a community of nature, and we don't even have a choice of putting ourselves first. That's called suicide. Putting humans before nature is called suicide. And because it takes time and we're using fossil fuels to overcome the negative effects, we don't realize it's suicide. You know, one of the things you see in the movie is that it passes fast, but we've taken 90% of the large fish in the ocean. 90%. And so why don't we know that? Why aren't we suffering? Because we use fossil fuels to run these giant fish farms. You probably know more about this than I do. To grow, raise salmon that still keep, you know, harming the ocean. But so we can pretend we still have fish. You know, so we've ran through most of the surface water for this civilization. Most of it's used for agriculture. So what do? We tap into these ancient underground aquifers. We build dams and dam up rivers and pump them over mountains. And when I brought up the water issue while I was making the film to some people, they're like, oh, we're going to use nuclear power to pump even deeper or salty aquifers out towards Texas and, you know, to purify the water. I'm like, when will the madness stop? It's like, but do you understand what I'm saying about the illusion that everything's going to be okay because we're okay, and that's undergirded by this massive fossil fuel expenditure that we're still tapping into?
I completely agree with you, and for me, that also, I mean, the whole solar and wind illusion are merely extensions of that same delusion, that this notion that one can continue this rapacious party a little bit longer by harvesting yet different forms of energy.
Yes, let's say that everything that renewable proponents said was true.
Which it's not, of course. But yes.
That they are 100% clean, and somehow they're just produced from, you know, extra grass and bunny fluff or something, and don't use resources. Let's just say that we get this magic thing like from one of the recent, you know, science fiction or comic book movies where you just have this energy supply that you put on your chest and it just makes you fly around the universe. Let's say that all came true. Well, we're going to kill ourselves faster, because that story is still the story of, you know, the sky turns white every day and people don't even notice it just from our jet travel. You know, we're going to have solar powered or magic energy powered bulldozers. I was just reading the first few pages of the draft of your book. It's just mind blowing. I mean, we don't even realize that agriculture, nobody has said that. I mean, just what you said, that we haven't even invented a sustainable system of agriculture. Is there even one? We're not even asking those questions. But that plow being powered by what? Wind energy? What's going to change? So even if we did have a magic free source, unless we completely change who we are and what we are, it's just we know what we'll do with it. We'll just keep on doing what we're doing, and we'll accelerate what we're doing. But what you see in the movie is that, as you were indicating, these two systems are not, they're the same thing. And one of the things I couldn't put in the movie, if you allow me to say, is that there was never giant hydroelectric. Do you ever think about that? Before fossil fuels. Why? Because to get vast quantities of concrete and steel and copper and all the bulldozing required, it couldn't happen without fossil fuels. So hydroelectric is really underwritten by fossil fuels. Nuclear. We didn't get nuclear until fossil fuels. Why? Because this plant they're building, I think in Tennessee, they're still building a plant. I think it's in Tennessee. It's costing $25 billion. What does that represent? Concrete, uranium mining, steel, aluminum, rare earths, you know, all the things that go into $25 billion of resources, $25 billion of fossil fuel impact. Somebody once said, and I haven't been able to verify it, but that if we attempted to build out enough nuclear to power the world, that it would use so much concrete that it would be game over for climate change. Because as you know, concrete is the third largest contributor to climate change. So then you think about, well, what about renewables? Well, people were using low-tech versions of wind several thousand years ago to grind grain and move water. The Chinese, the Persians, and then the Europeans. Whether that's sustainable or at what level is another question, but low-tech uses of these energy sources have been around for a while. The sun was used to light torches by the Romans, I think, in the 3rd century BC. The Romans, as they ran out of resources, actually tried to redesign their buildings to work with the sun. So the photovoltaic effect was first discovered in, I think, around 1850. So we didn't get the ability to produce solar and wind technologies until a giant fossil fuel-based industrial civilization emerged. We didn't have nuclear before that. We didn't have massive hydroelectric before that. We didn't have solar and wind. So what you see in the movie is that these things are not separate. They're precisely things that require the same industrial processes as everything else in the culture. And in a way, they're an additional burden because the relationship between carbon and everything in our industrial civilization is so profound. I don't know if that came across in the movie or maybe it did with concrete, but, including how you start a solar panel, you need to put carbon in there. It's not just the coal to power the smelter, but you directly have to use coal. So the very birth of a solar panel requires not sand, but rare mined quartz, coal, and then an enormous amount of energy to melt all this stuff. And that's just the first part of many processes to get to that silicon wafer for the solar panel. So this is it's been a long journey unraveling this. And some people are going, oh, this film is old. It's old because it took us a long time to unravel this. And it moves through the journey of discovery. It took Ozzie Zehner, the author of Green Illusions, who is in the film and worked with me on the film. It took us a while to even discover how the solar panels were made, that industrial process, because it's something, it's almost like how sausages are made. You don't want to see it. You don't want to know. And they don't want you to know. So what's the purpose of all this? It's to bring us back to what you were talking about. This story of technology is going to save us. If we're going to look back someday and go, how the hell did Earth-centered people and hippies like me, get convinced that giant industrial technological machines were going to save us? That's like one of the greatest illusions of all times. That story has to end for us to have the new story, whatever that story is going to be, of how we're going to get the hell through this. Not by we, I mean both humans and the rest of the remaining life on Earth.
Tragedies or cons or something of the last 30 years is that so much of, at one point, a lot of the environmental movement was about protecting wild places and wild beings. And somehow is probably not blaming enough. But anyway, in the last 30 years, so much of the environmental movement has been turned into a lobbying arm of specific sectors of the capitalist economy, by which I mean wind and solar sectors of the capitalist economy. And that's an extraordinary coup. And I think one of the things that I don't remember if you and I talked about this in emails before the interview or if I was talking about this with a dear friend of mine who's a radical sociologist at Humboldt State University about your film. He and I were talking about your film last night, and I don't remember if you said this or if he said this, that before the environmental movement can return to its roots of being about protecting wild nature, the story that's happened the last 30 years, this transformation to being a lobbying arm of industrial capitalism and attempting to protect not wild nature, but civilization, that movement really needs to die.
I agree 100%. And, we don't need to get into this right now, but just suffice it to say that what you've went through with raising questions and what I've went through, what I'm going through right now, I have sympathy for those. So many, I think, academics, so many writers, so many activists, so many indigenous people, so many just, humans who are observant. Notice the truth and are aware of it. And then if you're at an institution as an academic and you raise these questions, you're going to get slaughtered. I mean, you're going to be in real trouble. And I think we've got ourselves into huge trouble on the left, if I may include me, at least on the left, because you're just not even permitted to ask questions. I mean, what the hell happened to discourse? But if people get all along. I was at a meeting with a friend at UC Berkeley, and it's like a meeting of supposed environmental people, oriented people, sustainability people, and just the schemes to manage the world, to dump iron filings in the ocean, to put stuff in the atmosphere. It was just like, how do you even respond to that? But those become the little rock stars often. Well, the people that raise the questions that you've raised, for decades, and I'm raising here, it's, I don't know what view of experience, but it's just, the only thing I realized what I was in for is part of the journey was, and this is a great learning experience, was that they wanted to bring four biomass plants to Traverse City. In fact, I was leaving right in town in those days, and one of them was going to be sited like within blocks from my house. And here I was, my journey started with me, as a kid loving the trees and then noticing the trees were sick and wondering, what the hell are they trying to tell us? Why are all these trees falling apart? And why is nobody noticing? And so that's, my heart was really in the tree part of the story then. And then they're going to bring this power plant that's going to burn trees. So, I researched it. I went around to all the other environmental groups locally and said, will you join me on this? This doesn't look too good. And no response. At one thing, one of the guys, we started talking about it and he was in favor of it. He's for and walked away. I said, well, what about, we stopped the tire burning power plant that was going to come to here. We stopped a coal plant. Why would we? And that's where he got upset. So, aside from one guy from the Sierra Club, and one group that helped us put on a forum, nobody would help. And so I went on the radio the first day, the college radio station, to talk about the horrors of biomass and what I had found out. And to my surprise, sitting there in the room were two people from the local utility pushing this and two people from environmental groups. Four people there to oppose me at one single little college radio show. They brought in people from Michigan State, Michigan Tech, from Lansing, from forestry departments. They brought in, they even at the end brought in somebody all the way from Western Canada. And this was towards the end of the fight when they had forums and all this stuff. But this, so I was so stressed out and pissed off, I couldn't go to things. So I was having friends were there and they were texting me, oh, this person's here from NextGen or something like that, NextTerra, I know, one of these things. I'm like, promoting biomass and this works great. I'm like looking it up. I'm like, oh, they're involved in the tar sands. Huh, that's interesting. Well, I guess that makes sense because you can cut down the trees where you're getting ready for the tar sands and then you can turn them into biomass. I mean, so that's when I realized that, by the way, the biomass was defeated. The last forum, 95%. Of the community was against it. So I learned the hard way that sometimes if you're going to defend trees, you're going to go it alone, even when secretly half the environmentalists are telling you they don't like it. And I learned that if people learn what some of these things are, they can be stopped.
Well, you're not alone. And you're not alone because even in the film, there are local environmentalists. See, when I complain about the environmental movement, I'm really complaining about the large scale. There are great local environmentalists all over the world. And a lot of these local environmentalists are fighting tooth and nail to protect the land they love, whether it's from a big timber company that's cutting for plywood or a big timber company that's cutting for biomass, or whether it's a power company putting in wind and solar. As you know, and you cite some of them, and you interview some of them in the film, these local environmentalists who are fighting.
Yeah, thank you for being clear about that, because, you know, we wound up with maybe this took 2 years, and we wound up with the ex-mayor, who was kind of an independent, and we wound up with ex-Sierra Club members and people who worked on, anti-fracking issues. And it really brought us together. And what's weird is I would go on right-wing radio and talk about this, not just the liberal, and they wouldn't know what to make of me because I was an environmentalist questioning things about environmentalism. And I was bringing up other things, and it actually kind of broke the ice, and we just had a conversation as humans. So that was an unexpected benefit. But the other thing I learned just by grassroots is, so the way I figured out how to do this is I just started asking around who else has actually stopped something, because I was seeing mines come to our area, and occasionally something would be stopped. But, you know, that just what I saw was environmental groups getting involved with supposedly having sustainable forest plans and supposedly having, environmentally friendly mining regulations that might even stop the mining. But I saw that it was a complete failure. So I called around and I actually started talking to some people who had fought for the forests out in the Pacific Northwest and told me what it took and what their relationship with the big green groups and how the green groups, if they did succeed, would kind of take credit. And then I talked to some people who had stopped biomass plants, and they described to me, you know, exactly how vehement and clear you needed to be, and that you had to be willing. So, yes, there are many people fighting things, and those are not our heroes right now. The heroes are Elon Musk, you know, who wants us to keep on growing and, buy more electric cars. The heroes are not the people who've chosen to live a different way and to think a different way and to fight things, usually with their own resources, you know, with no funding.
Absolutely. No funding. I want to mention a couple images from the film that just tore me to shreds. One of them was the ending, which I don't know if you want to ruin or not. So I'll just say that the ending left me sobbing. And then another one that I know hit me, and also I have discussed this with some activist friends that just destroyed us, was the chipping of the Joshua trees. I can hardly say it without crying.
Okay. Yeah, I thought you were going to mention the biofuel part, but the...
The horse and cow?
Yeah.
But yeah.
The Joshua tree. It's funny you should say that, because...
A very bad one too.
That's and by the way, it's good to be aware those are in there, and I was careful. There's technically, it could be a lot worse. It's just giving you a sense of what it is, and then we cut away.
Oh no, I'm not saying you shouldn't have put them in. I'm saying it's those are images that will stick with me for life and will fuel my own work and fuel my own resolve. And then also I wanted to mention I know and have interviewed some people who have opposed solar facilities in the desert. And I want to give you one more image, if you don't mind.
Sure.
It just broke my heart, which is that they would remove desert tortoises, and they would also crush a whole bunch of them underneath the caterpillars. And they would remove the desert tortoises, and the desert tortoises would come home.
Wow. That's amazing.
They would be pacing back and forth outside the fence and die of heat stroke.
That's not a story you hear in the Clean Tech magazine, is it?
No.
It's not a story that the people who are complaining right now, we didn't tell the truth about renewables. There's a lot more truths to tell.
You also didn't tell about the birds being burned in the air when they fly over Ibumpah.
Yeah, and... The Joshua trees,
their ears ruptured by wind, their ears and their hearts ruptured.
And the bats, right, with the wind power. And the Joshua tree story really got to me. I'm a woods person, and but the first time I went to the desert, and just I was on the highway, we were flying down the road, but I just, as soon as I had a sense, because I was in the space of absorbing. Just I'm in this landscape for the first time, and I actually started crying. I was like, how can anyone mess with this? I just, you know, I mean, as much as I care about trees, when I saw the desert and the, it was just, you know, it's hard to describe. It's just something was speaking to me. And so even though I've only been to the desert a few times, I came to understand that there's can be as much carbon underground as there is in a forest. And that there's this just ancient life. So I love the music that's to that scene, and it meant a lot to be able to get that music. And, you know, oddly enough for me, that's probably the most emotional scene in the film. And, you know, and it's not just us saying that the Joshua trees are being cut down for solar. We use a news clip to say that.
Another thing, in one of the responses to your, and by the way, most of the responses I've seen to your film that are negative are, I was talking to my sociologist friend about this last night. He's like, why is anybody taking them seriously? Solar trade magazines? I mean, if this were timber industry magazines, timber trade magazines, nobody would take them seriously. If this was a mining trade magazine. But when it's solar trade, they've been able to insinuate themselves into pretending that they're environmentalists. Anyway, one of the responses that some guy was laughing at you for saying that it was that they had turned it into a dead zone by putting a solar factory in there. And he put this, by putting a solar harvesting facility, and he put this picture from Google of this big solar array and saying basically, ha, this isn't a dead zone. And it's like, I'm sorry, from the perspective of somebody who cares about the desert, this is in fact a dead zone. I mean, this is, they cleared away all the Joshua trees. They cleared away the desert tortoises. The birds who fly over die. I mean, how bad does it have to be for it to be called a dead zone?
Right. And, you know, we show you that one because that was right there. I mean, we actually just did go there to see what had happened with the solar array that, because we had been there a few years before, but we didn't really stop and look. And we wanted to talk to people in the town, which you see in the movie, to see how things were coming along and how that was affecting them. And so because they had removed the previous, maybe the second or third round of solar technology, now it was laid bare what was happening there. And it was just really, truly sand, which is not the desert. That's not the desert. It's blowing sand. That's, you know, some other desert somewhere else, but that's not the Southwest. And, you know, we were at Ivanpah, which it can be deceptive because there's more green at Ivanpah. But like you just described, the ecosystem is completely altered. And something about our brains, because there's some shrubbery that they left, thinks, oh, it's okay. You know, yeah, they didn't destroy nature. It's all fine. But I think the reason people are freaking out, number one, if your livelihood depends on something, isn't there a saying, you have a very hard time grasping that?
It's Upton Sinclair. It's hard to make a man understand something when his job depends on him not understanding it.
Right. And the other thing is, again, to revisit the issue of story, I think you just having the privilege of reading the first few pages of your soon-to-be-released book, really feeling the poetry with which you write that and the depth and the emotion amid, you know, just relentless, you know, I don't know if you want to call it science or facts or just describing what is. You know, we're protecting ourselves from really absorbing the full weight of who we are and what we've done with these fantasies that these things are going to make it okay. And that's why the story, climate change plus green technology means we're saved, is so destructive. Even though climate change is real and terrible, it keeps us out of the story of, oh, really, let's really assess what we've done and who we are as a species and how we've interacted with every single landscape. And let's think about where we need to be and where we need to go that would be survivable for the humans we love and for all the non-human species we love. I think once, you know, based on my work as a therapist, once the story that's protecting you from those emotions gets stripped away, you're left with, some interesting choices. And quite often, as brief, very briefly alluded to in the middle of the film, you know, you lash out at those who strip that story away, even if that story has to be stripped away for us to survive. So I don't know, didn't know what else to do but this. I didn't want to make a movie shattering all these illusions. But once I realized it was what was in the way, I had no choice, whatever cost to myself, because I'm insignificant. You know, what matters is, you know, all the things around us that are going to be here and keep life going or die and not keep life going. That's what matters. I mean, I'd like to have some fun. Don't get me wrong. And be around for a while, but, you know.
Of course, but that's central to everything is that, I mean, of course we all want to have some fun along the way, but you're not the point and I'm not the point. And only a sociopath would really think that I'm the entire point or you're the entire point when the point is the larger community and the health of the land base. That's everything.
Maybe that's a good summary for what this journey has made us into, is that, you know, I think most people are good at heart and most people care a lot, but it's kind of the, some part of us has been converted into, you know, I don't know if sociopath is the right word, but some part of us have been walled off by all these goodies and all this technology and all these dreams and by this seductive civilization that we're surrounded by and live in. So we wind up, even some part of, I think most people knows the truth, but yeah, it's very hard to experience it right now.
Well, thank you so much for all of that. And we have like 1 minute left. Is there any, I mean, that's a great place to end, but is there anything else you want to say?
Sometimes you have to go through pain to come out the other side. And if we don't go through that pain, we're not going to come out the other side. But, you know, the whole reason to go through the pain is really love. Love for our fellow humans, love for everything around us. And we still have blue whales. We still have monarch butterflies. There's still a handful of redwoods. There's still a few gorillas, still a few orangutans. There's still the largest creature that ever lived on this planet, the largest animal, blue whales are still in the ocean. So that's where I get my hope from is, you know, we go through this pain of awareness, but we come out into the joy of realization. So it might sound corny, but I've seen people recover and get through things. And there is a space on the other side where even though we know things are bad, we can, it's like the joy of just engaging in the real task before us, which is figuring out what our relationship is with this living planet and how we can save it so we save ourselves.
Well, thank you so much for all of that. And thank you for your absolutely wonderful movie, Planet of the Humans. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Jeff Gibbs. This is Derek Jenton for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. Woo!